dialed in so far, and welcome to the UX Mastery Q&A. We've got Matt and Luke on the line. We're just going to wait for a few minutes for all of the attendees to join in before we kick things off. How's everybody doing this morning? It's morning in Australia anyway. Not sure if you guys are familiar with the GoToWebinar control panel, but there's a chat and there's a question, and it's all a bit confusing actually. Can you guys hear me okay? Silence.
They can't talk back to us.
They can't. They can chat though, if anyone wants to chat. Ah, Dex can hear us fine, that's wonderful. Luke and I haven't done anything like this before, so there may be a few little bumps along the road. Appreciate your patience as we iron out the kinks. Should be fun though. Very appreciative of anyone who's joined us in a time zone that's not very convenient. It's pretty hard to find the time that suits absolutely everybody. Currently 10 a.m. in Melbourne, Australia for Luke and myself. But I know that some people are staying up late to join us, and we hope to make that worth your while. Behind the scenes, look at how organised or unorganised we are. Well, it's 10 o'clock, so we'll kick things off, and I'll say once again, welcome to everybody, and thank you for... Thank you for joining us. We've got Luke and Matt on the line from UX Mastery. What we're going to do today is hopefully answer a bunch of the questions that we had come through from attendees to this webinar. We've had almost 60. So we've got 60 minutes and 60 questions. I'm not sure if we're going to get through the entire list, but we'll see how we go. Very quickly, if you're not familiar with UX Mastery, then I'm surprised that you're here, but hopefully you've all seen our website, uxmastery.com. We like to think of UX Mastery as being more than just the website. We're quite proud of the fact that we're building a community around user experience design and user experience training. So we do have a Twitter account where we like to tweet interesting links, both to articles that we've written as well as stuff that we find on the web that we like. And we try and do the same thing through the other channels, Facebook and our email newsletter, which comes out every 2 weeks as well. Hopefully a bunch of you guys are already subscribed to at least one of those channels. We're trying to find our way with doing some training. Both Luke and I are quite passionate about not only user experience design, but about helping others develop as designers. So we do have an ebook that's in the works, which we'll tell you a little bit more about at the end of the session. We've started dabbling with doing some in-person workshops. I taught one in Sydney a couple of weeks ago, and I've got another one coming up later in the year in Sydney. But we do want to try and take those workshops and convert them into an online format so that basically so we can reach as many people as possible rather than just making it an Australia-only thing. So watch this space on that. Very quickly, a bit about Luke and myself. I'm just including this information, not because we're trying to big note ourselves or because we're looking for a job or anything, but just so that you guys have some context about the answers to the questions. So a lot of the questions, there's no real one right answer or a black and white answer, but we're going to be trying to answer based on our experience. So this is our experience. I work as a freelance user experience designer, and I started UX Mastery last year with Luke. Some of the clients that I've done work for include Australia Post, SitePoint, which is like a startup incubator here in Melbourne that launched a couple of well-known startup companies. 99designs is one of them. It's done quite well. I've done some work for the Australian Labor Party and then a handful of other clients. And the thing that I am most passionate about is communicating visually. So the sketch notes on the site, one example of that. So I've always been a visual thinker, and communicating using visuals is really what I'm most passionate about. I'll let Luke introduce himself.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Similar to Matt, I've got a background in web user experience design. I currently do some work for Penguin Books, a couple of days a week there, working in their marketing department, working with designers and developers to do ebooks and apps and websites. A few other clients as well, including the Australian Open and the Blake Prize. I've been doing UX-related things probably for about 10 years. Stuff that I'm very passionate about is design with soul, or design with some of that human meaning behind it. So kind of stuff that I like writing about and talking about.
Very good. And you might have just picked up on the fact there that Luke's come down with a bit of a sniffle overnight. So if his voice doesn't hold out, then I'll be... I have no problem with talking. So we do have a rough agenda for today. Thank you to everybody who included a question when you registered for the webinar. We got nearly 60 questions come through. So what we did was we sorted through them all. We looked for duplicates. We grouped them. And we're going to tackle them in order of the most popular groups of questions that came through. So the number one category of questions was career related. So we'll tackle the career questions first, then we'll look at questions relating to education and training. There are quite a few questions about how to evangelize and champion and sell user experience within an organization. Then we'll tackle UX process and UX techniques. There are a few specific questions in there. Talk about roles, the role of a UXer, and the different roles within a team. And lastly, tools, resources, and other miscellaneous questions that have come through. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hand control of the webinar over to Luke, who has the question list. And doing that should mean that you guys can see the questions in advance and you can see what's coming up. And that should hopefully reduce any other questions that come through as being duplicates. So have you got that spreadsheet there, Luke?
I do. Here we go. So here's a list of questions, everyone. You can look ahead. Off we go.
Cool. So we'll keep the highlight on the question that we're talking about at the time that we're talking about it. So number one question, and definitely a question that people ask on the website quite a bit: how do I get started in the UX field? Well, conveniently, there is an article on UX Mastery that tackles this. You guys might have seen it. Maybe you haven't, but basically, I believe there's a bunch of ways that are really useful for getting started, and I've broken them up into five sections. So the first section is about getting educated, about learning stuff, and we have become a big fan of the online course that David Travis has published over at Udemy. It's called User Experience, the Ultimate Guide. And I said in the article that we hate this course because we wish that we'd created it. It really is. It's a remarkable achievement what David's put together in this video course. There's 7.5 hours of video, and it covers everything primarily usability related. He touches on visual principles. He talks about really everything related to the user experience spectrum and primarily usability. And the thing I love about this course is that he's really anchored all of the advice in solid theory. So he starts out with talking about the ISO standard for usability, which I didn't know existed before I reviewed this course. So that was interesting for me. Yeah, it's a great course. It's about $200. If you use the discount code on UX Mastery, which you can find on the site, we'll include it in the notes at the end of this webinar as well. You can get 20% off. But in terms of getting educated, yes, there are a ton of books out there that we love and recommend, but that course, it's a remarkable achievement what he's pulled together, and will certainly be a great place for anyone who's looking to get a good grounding in user experience. The next thing that I recommend you do is get the right tools. Did you want to add anything to the education stuff, Luke? I know we have a few other education-related questions, but...
I mean, there's things like books for beginners we've got in our resources section that I think would be excellent introduction to. But yeah, I totally agree that David's course would be my first sort of port of call if I was going to be getting started.
Yeah, we have when we started UX Mastery, we had grand plans to create a similar course, and then we saw it. We're like, he beat us to it. And that's not to say that, you know, there isn't room for other online courses, but you know, we're kind of busy at the moment and haven't got around to pulling together something that comprehensive. So maybe that'll happen at some point down the track. But in the meantime, we're more than happy to recommend David's course. He's a nice bloke. He knows his stuff. He's been teaching this stuff for years as well as being a practitioner. So in terms of an education point of view, he's done a great job. I talk about the tools. Specifically, I talk about prototyping and user testing tools. So Balsamiq Mockups is the prototyping tool that I'm a fan of. There's a ton out there that are all excellent. It just happens to be the one that I've latched onto and used the most. But in terms of pulling together a prototype of a web app or a mobile app, I'm a big fan. And then user testing software, screen recording software. I use Silverback. It's a Mac-only app, but there are plenty of other tools out there for doing screen capture and recording the audio. So what that software does is it captures the screen while the user's using it, and it also uses the computer's inbuilt mic to record their voice. And so if you're facilitating a user testing session, what you want to do is encourage the participant to talk out loud, tell you what's going on in their head, tell you why they're confused when they get confused, tell you what they make of the page when they're looking at it for the first time, really get them to explain and help you get inside their head, and then that records that audio. And some of the tools like Silverback also use the computer's built-in camera to record their face. I don't think this is necessarily vital to a good user testing session, but it can be useful to have in the little bottom right corner the person's facial expressions and kind of a bit more body language about what's going on as they're interacting with the app. So the reason I say get the right tools as a number two point for getting started is because once you're armed with these two tools, you can go do user testing just using your laptop. You don't need expensive labs. You don't need to hire out a venue to set up, you know, the equipment. You've just got this portable user testing lab in your backpack, in your shoulder bag, and you can just set up anywhere and do user testing. So once you've got those tools in place, you can do user testing within your organization. Maybe you want to help out a friend who's got a website. You can do some user testing for him. You can do it in a cafe. You can do it in the office. You can do it anywhere. And the more user testing you do, the more insights you get into how people interact with your software and the more you learn about usability. Number three, get some experience. So once you've got those tools in place, you're well positioned to go and actually do some user testing. And I think that like education is fantastic, whether it's a formal degree or whether it's a course like David's. But really for me, the most I've done in terms of learning about user experience is from doing it. And if you've got the tools and you've got a client who is partial to having you help them usability test their software, then that's the best way to get started, get some experience. Any thoughts or anything you wanted to add there, Luke? I'm going on a bit here.
I'd totally reiterate that. Like it's just jump in the deep end and start applying the principles if you can on work you're already doing, or like Matt says, work for some friends or, you know, local charity or community group or something like that. Totally, so jumping in that deep end and just getting started will teach you more than learning off a course or out of a book.
Yeah, because David's course is excellent, but the one thing that it's lacking is actual experience. So you can watch a video about how to do something, you can understand the theory, you can know it all, but it doesn't give you the confidence to apply it. And that's the key here, because, you know, being a good UX designer, I believe, is a lot to do with confidence, whether you're facilitating a session, whether you're conducting a user testing session. It's all good to know what to do, but you know, need to be comfortable and have those people skills and that confidence to actually pull it off. So this is how you get that experience. And I think that's a great idea, Luke, working for a non-profit or a charity, that's close to home that you believe in, you're going to be passionate about. Luke and I have got a non-profit organization that we're using as a kind of a test bed for trying out some UX stuff. So we're working for free for those guys. And it's been invaluable. Next point is...
I was just going to say before you went on, Matt. Yes. One of the advantages of building up some experience is when you are sort of getting started, maybe applying for some jobs and stuff and being able to demonstrate your experience by showing a portfolio or something like that is also very useful. It's not the be-all and end-all, but having had that experience, getting it all under your belt and being able to sort of communicate that by explaining to a potential employer, you know, here's what I did in this particular case, or here's some examples of the type of work I've done, will certainly be very helpful in getting a job.
That's so true. And we'll talk a little bit about portfolios later in this section, I think. But certainly what Luke said in terms of being able to talk about your process, if you know all the theory, you can't really answer the question, when was the time that you applied this or that you did that? So getting that experience, and whether it's a paid client or whether it's time that you've volunteered, that doesn't matter, because if you've got the experience in doing it, you can talk about it, you can explain your process, and that's what people are looking for when they're looking for a UX designer. Next one is to get connected, certainly by participating in the UX Mastery community. I hope that you've felt more connected to some of the thought leaders out there in the user experience space on Twitter, but also in person. There's a lot of value to be had from connecting with like-minded souls. Luke and I had a chat, I remember it must have been about 6 months ago, we were talking about how user experience is such a broad umbrella term, and we were trying to work out what it was that meant that when we went along to a UX Melbourne meetup, we still felt connected to these people, even though they had various different backgrounds. And the one thing that we settled on was this concept of empathy. So good UXers have good empathy for their users and for their stakeholders. And it's that warm, fuzzy feeling that makes you feel good about your job for me. And for the same reason, it makes you relate to other UXers in the field. Agreed?
Definitely. It's a, I think, it, like you say, getting connected, the soft skills part of the job is a large portion of that. You know, being able to facilitate meetings and, you know, be friendly, be transparent in what you're doing, all that kind of stuff is certainly, you know, in the mix with when you're networking people, for sure.
And it's such a different world these days where you can connect one-on-one with thought leaders that have written books that are presented at conferences and just hit them up and have a chat. And I feel really privileged to have interviewed folks like Jeff Gothelf and Donna Spencer from UX Australia, just because with the technology these days, it's really easy to connect one-on-one with these people. The next point I suggested in getting started is to get a mentor. And a lot of people struggle with this. They find it really hard. There's always lots of reasons why, oh, I can't find the right person, or I live in a remote location and so it's really hard for me to connect with someone. And I think that you need to push through that and find a way. I mentioned that technology's changed the way we connect with people, and there's really no excuse not to put yourself out there and connect with someone. For me, finding a mentor has been crucial in terms of how I look at my career. If I look back and look at various stages where I felt like I really achieved a major milestone or put myself out of my comfort zone to take it to the next level, that was as a result of my mentor pushing me, encouraging me to not be complacent and take the easy option. So I've been very fortunate that my mentor, even though we don't catch up all that often, it's been months since I've seen him, and we actually haven't spoken that much about specific process or techniques. Like I had this vision of a mentor, you know, explaining to me the details of how I would tackle a complex design problem. But actually the conversations we've had have been more about career and more about, he's the one that encouraged me to leave my salaried role and go freelance. He's the one who encouraged me to get up and do some public speaking and put myself out there a bit. You'd be surprised sometimes if you find the right person, how the conversations travel. Have you got a mentor,
I think it's
Luke?
Important to get that. I don't have a mentor at the moment. I am certainly interested in sort of learning off anyone that I can. I have a few colleagues, and obviously go along to a few events, and I think that somewhat goes towards getting some of that input and learning from somewhere that isn't my own experience, which I think is the important thing. You can't sort of, obviously you can't design in a vacuum, but you can't sort of develop your skills and things purely by experience. You're going to be reinventing the wheel. And I think having that personal feedback, someone who knows you or can see you and what you're doing, means you don't, if you don't have that awareness of yourself, they can certainly suggest some things for you. So I went through a stage of looking for a mentor, and the Information Architecture Institute had a few things, and I had a few inquiries going there, but unfortunately I didn't sort of push through, and I wish that I had. So.
And I suppose the other thing to remember is that your mentor can be valuable in terms of connections, both for jobs or clients if you're freelancing. I've had a little bit of work come through my mentor, and I've sent him a little bit of work. So it's another valuable connection, if anything. And then the last point is to get hired. And we talked about portfolios a little bit earlier. Lots of questions that I've had have been about what should I include in my portfolio. So very quickly, portfolio and a summary, I believe, should be different from a visual designer's portfolio, because the stuff that we create isn't necessarily as pretty or, you know, colorfully compelling to look at. The important thing about your portfolio should be that it shows you have a process, and it is the launch pad for you to talk about that process.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's all also about this, the story of the development of the product that you've been working on. So rather than a visual design artifact that's the end result, a lot of user experience work is the process of design and being able to either tell stories of how things changed, or, you know, how you made a bit of a difference, or being able to demonstrate that stuff by showing before and after, or, you know, points where you had particular insights into the work that you're working on.
Yeah, so the before and after is definitely going to be compelling if you've got hard data. So if you've got conversion rates before you redesign the checkout page, and then conversion rates after, and assuming that you do a good job and those conversion rates go up, then there's some hard data that you can say, hey, this is the process I followed for this page. This is what it looked like first, after it looked like this, and this is how much it helped and how much money it made the business. That's the way to make a compelling case for being hired as a UX designer. But also, in terms of triggering conversations about your process, stuff like photographs of you facilitating a session, or perhaps doing some affinity diagramming, or showing the messy workspace that you've created so that people can get an insight into how you think and how you work. Yeah. Okay, so we've just spent 20 minutes on the first question. So hopefully we've spoken
a few of these things as well.
That's right. Hopefully we've spoken to a few of the points in the questions ahead. But let's take a look at the next list. So making the leap from web to UX, really it's a similar path, I believe, and that I would recommend. You need to get an understanding about usability and about the user experience field. So following those same steps, definitely recommended. In terms of the web, I think if you're a designer or a developer or maybe a content person or a project manager in the web space, you've got an advantage because, you know, the terminology and the challenges that are unique to the web is stuff that you've already covered off. You don't need to learn the basics of that. You're probably all over responsive design, and really it's just about getting that understanding of human behavior and finding a process that works for you that is user-centered. So, yeah, the same advice applies. Anything else to add there?
I would just say that, yeah, probably as a web designer, there's some things that you're already doing that are possibly more sort of UX-related. So, you know, design research, talking to people who might be using the product, or talking to stakeholders is certainly a sort of big part of the input. And if you're already doing that already, then, you know, it's not such a daunting sort of prospect. So making that jump across is probably more a, a definition of your priorities in doing user-centered design rather than a totally new field?
Yeah, for me, it was a big deal for me to come to terms with the idea that I was being arrogant in the design process that I was following. Like, I wasn't being transparent. I was expected to go away and make magic and come back and present it, and that's what I would do. I'd put my headphones on and I'd go into the creative zone and I would, create a couple of designs and then pick my favorite and show all three to the stakeholders, and we'd talk about one or two and then we'd launch one of them. And there was no explicit user involvement at all. We just thought we knew best, because I guess it was embarrassing to consider the prospect that we didn't know who our users were. I think I blogged about it.
Yeah.
Sorry, go.
So I was just going to say, detaching your ownership of the design. Like, if you're a designer, then, you feel that your expertise is being employed to be able to provide, those artifacts or the end results. Whereas I think detaching your ownership from the design is relaxing your thinking as a design expert and listening to the opinions of other people, users who may not necessarily have design skills. And that's a very challenging thing to do, to sort of take what they say and make it work, but it results in a better result.
And it's interesting to see, if I look at my role over the last couple of years, I've become more of a design facilitator than a hands-on designer. The idea of being collaborative and involving stakeholders and staff and users in the design process and letting them drive it and being just the conduit to make it happen has, that's made for better outcomes. I'm loath to say it's made me a better designer, because that sounds like my skills at designing have gotten better, but I think it's more about becoming that design facilitator and owning the process and getting everyone involved, and then the outcome is better. And like you said, the ownership is detached, but it's for the best. And if you can accept that, I think that you'll be a better UXer as a result.
Totally, yeah, it's very true.
There's a question there that says, how can I make the jump from QA to UX? I assume QA means quality assurance. I'm not going to speak about quality assurance specifically because I don't know much about that industry, but I will say that UX has come from a very diverse range of backgrounds, and I think that regardless of the industry that you've been in, there's going to be some stuff that you have learned that will be valuable and that you can leverage in the UX space. So whether it's as a QA person, whether you're an industrial designer or a developer or a project manager, or I'll even say something non-digital, there's things like communication skills, like collaboration skills, people skills, these kind of core business skills that sound like soft skills that are really peripheral to doing your job. They're a core part of being a UX designer. So could you make the jump? Absolutely. Leverage that stuff that is going to come in handy for dealing with people and for being transparent and for championing user-centered design, and you'll be well on your way. How do I break into the UX field? I think we've covered. Preparing to apply for a job. We talked about portfolios. Did you have anything to add to portfolios or connections there, Luke?
I think I sort of mentioned it a bit before. I think portfolios, as I say, aren't the be-all and end-all, but they certainly are a useful tool in being able to communicate your experience. And as Matt sort of talked about, the personal networking, if there's been people that you've worked with in the past or who, you've been colleagues with for a while, then they'll obviously be able to advocate for you too. So, as you said, sort of being able to get those opportunities and hear about the jobs going, and usually because it's a fairly sort of trusted role, I think people don't necessarily put someone in cold into a position of responsibility, so it might come in by a reference or someone who can actually vouch for you. So portfolios certainly help in terms of demonstrating and giving some surety about your process and previous results you've been able to achieve, but there's a lot more things to consider in there too.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you guys have heard the statistic that 90% of jobs aren't advertised. And, you know, I think it's pretty hard to actually measure that. But in terms of my experience, I think that it's probably bang on, you know, that most of the jobs that I've been fortunate enough to get over the years haven't come because they were advertised on a jobs board. They've come because somebody spoke to me about something or got wind of a project that they liked and then asked who the designer was, and that person said, oh, it was this guy. So in terms of, yeah, that those connections, it's going to be valuable. Next step for a career in UX after some training?
That really depends on the position or the context that you're in. So, you know, you might be working in-house, maybe you've got a team around you. You're probably going to look at developing some skills to complement those people around you, or introducing what you've learned in that sort of training and getting a bit of culture change happening if you need to, or encouraging the team in a certain direction. That's going to be a bit different too if you're working freelance, where you've got probably a little bit more control over your process or your approach, but yeah, it's going to really depend. I don't think you ever really stop training, so you probably do more training.
Yeah, assuming that the person asking this question has, for example, completed David's course but hasn't gotten any experience under their belt, then really, like, getting that experience is going to be the next big thing that you should focus on. So whether that's with a local charity or a friend's website, or whether it's you having a chat to your boss and saying, look, I really think we should do some user testing on this software that we're working on. Explain that it doesn't need to be like a week of your time. It can be an afternoon. And, you know, with your portable usability lab, with the software that I mentioned earlier, you can pull in a few people and put it in front, put the product in front of some participants and start that user feedback loop. Then your foot's in the door. And when people start seeing the value of that, especially if you show them the videos, recently at a client, I had a hard time convincing people that usability was a big issue with the products we were working on. And so I recorded some users struggling in front of it. And these people were just, they were struggling. They, you know, were all over the place. They couldn't find any of the information. They'd just go down these rabbit warrens and get stuck and frustrated. And all of that frustration I captured on video, and then I showed management and said, this is someone using your website. And it's pretty hard to not empathize with someone who's struggling that bad when they're failing in the task that has been given to them. And I won a lot of people over to the I think I put a lot of noses out of joint as well, but I also won a lot of backing on focusing on usability, and I like to think kind of planted the seeds for almost a form of culture change at that organization, because usability is getting more and more prioritized as a result of those user testing videos. So those videos can be very powerful politically if you need to get people on board. All right, what question are we up to? I've lost. Where are we, Luke?
I guess we're making slow progress through our list, but
yeah, that's all right.
Maybe pick and choose a few things out of here. The internships, as we mentioned, there's lots of opportunities around if you're networking with people. Internships, it's probably you need to be brave about, you know, finding someone who you would like to do some work with or an internship with, and just reaching out and saying, hey, look, you know, I'm really passionate about this sort of stuff. Is it possible for me to come in and meet you guys or see how you work, or, you know, co-work, or come and help you do some things? Creating your own opportunities like that is it's certainly been something that I've found helpful too.
I should mention that we had a gentleman in Melbourne, a young guy, approach us. I'm not sure if Ben's on the line or not, but Ben was really keen to find a mentor and asked me if I would mentor him, and I agreed. So we've been actually getting Ben involved in some of the not-for-profit work that we've been doing here in Melbourne. And it's been great to have him help us out because, you know, we have paying clients that are competing with our time. So having an extra helper has been terrific. But for him, it's been some experiences that he wouldn't have had otherwise. So it works both ways.
Yeah. So, yeah, get in touch with Interaction Design Association, ICDA, or any other sort of groups around
they'll be able to get in touch with something, or, you know, just reach out to whoever you sort of got on your horizon.
How can I become a better designer without a mentor? I would really recommend getting a mentor. I think that it's a strange question, because the value of having someone who you can confide in, who can give you some guidance and perspective, can't be understated. And so while I empathise with the fact that it can be hard to find the right person to play that role in your life, I certainly believe that it's worth pursuing. Yeah. Visual design background, what should I be focusing on to become a UX designer? Firstly, I'll suggest that if you come from a visual design background, I think you do have an advantage. While I do believe that having a visual background is not necessary to be a successful UXer, because tasks like conducting user interviews and doing user testing don't require you to have those visual skills. But in terms of being able to communicate visually, I think it's a real advantage. And so, yes, what should you be focusing on? The behavior stuff, the process, getting that user feedback loop, and divorcing ownership from the design. So whatever design process you used previously, I'm sure there's value in it, but becoming more transparent and involving the team and involving users is really what you should be focusing on next. And perhaps the final question for the career, we'll jump to the last one, which says how to source and hire talented UX designers. Luke, give us, if you had to hire a UX designer, what would you do?
Well, I'd be attending some of the UX events, I guess. So getting to know people personally, or being able to hear them pitch their work, that kind of thing. So, yeah, back into the personal networking kind of things. I might be looking up projects that I've heard about and looking at who's been behind that kind of work. That's probably where I'd start. Put the word out, networking, asking people. Maybe that's something we need to look at UX Mastery, sort of connecting people.
Yeah.
With opportunities.
You guys may be familiar with meetup.com, but I'm sure that if you're in a small or medium-sized city, there is going to be a UX meetup of some description near you, and it's probably on meetup.com. There's a great community here in Melbourne called UX Melbourne, which have a Google group and have regular meetups where they show videos of UX-related presentations, where they have a book club and everyone reads the same book and then we chat about it. And it's a great community, and it's a great way to meet people, and it's possibly a great way to hire people. So, yes, those connections are valuable. I guess trawling LinkedIn is probably what recruiters spend a bunch of time doing, and I'm sure there's value in looking at people's online profiles, but certainly like a trusted referral, someone that you've met or that someone that you trust has recommended, is going to be it's going to get you a long way there. All right, the training questions. First question here says, what is what are the best self-guided learning resources, books, references, or tutorials?
It's a good question. It's something we get asked a lot, and so much, in fact, that, you know, we've got some great stuff on the website. There's books and things. If you come to the resources section, here's some good books.
Yeah,
and particular sort of introduction to UX stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and it is our grand vision to filter this list a bit more, because we're conscious that the list of tools, the list of books, the list of courses is just kind of a big brain dump, and so very slowly we're working our way through filtering that list. So we've reviewed at least three of the courses, I think, so far, and we hope to review some of the books as well, and give you guys a bit more of kind of expert recommendations of what we think is good, rather than just the comprehensive, here's everything, blah.
Yeah, to be able to unpack that stuff. In particular, you know, if you guys have questions about, you know, I'm in this particular situation, what's going to be, you know, where should I start? Then certainly let us know and we can point you in the right direction. Or, you know, we might end up writing a blog post about it. So
that's right. Yeah. If there's something that on that resources section of the site that doesn't answer your question, then please email us so that we can add it. Definitely.
The two books I would particularly pull out of that list would be this one by Kenneth, Undercover User Experience Design. I found very useful for being able to explain a couple of key concepts. And the other one is this A Project Guide to UX Design, which is very practical, walks you through. It's got you know, bits and pieces you can apply fairly easily and immediately to what you're working on. They're two very practical books. Probably that Jesse James Garrett's Elements of User Experience is a sort of a foundational one, but it's a bit more abstract and theoretical, I guess. It certainly explains user experience mm-hmm. and the origins well, but yeah, it's not necessarily as practical as these other ones.
It can be good for getting someone who has no idea about user experience at all on board with the concept.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Next question.
So courses, true. There's a courses section of the website. We've listed all the online courses that we've found here. We'll put David's at the top because we think that's the best one. There's quite a few other ones. All these other ones down here. Some are paid, some are free. We haven't included the university courses yet because there's some sticking to online for the moment. But have a dig around in there, find something that might be useful for you.
Yeah, and if you take one of those courses and love it, write to us and let us know. We'd love to hear how you found it.
So this is this next question, learning UX as a soloist is a very interesting question. I was talking to Matt about it last night and conjures up pictures of user experience designers as musicians. And we had that article a while ago that referred to the idea of conducting an orchestra to produce a sort of a symphony of sounds as a UX designer, working with designers and developers and a team. So it's an interesting concept also because user experience is a very collaborative sort of role. So working as a soloist is a bit of a doesn't quite fit with that picture, but I guess talking about, you know, UX as a team of one is probably what was behind the question. I think you can never really work by yourself. I think you certainly need to be relying on users, and if you're doing design and development as well, then sure, you can roll up some things into one. But it's an interesting question. I could do a bit more thinking about that. What do you think, Matt?
I did publish an article on UX Mastery last year about being a remote UX designer, because sometimes the reality is that you're not on site with the client. They might be in another city or in another country even. So there's certainly some techniques and things that you can do to get a user-centered process happening for a project, even if you're remotely. So I'd recommend you go and check out that article and read about some of those techniques. But I agree with Luke in terms of the metaphor being a bit broken, because the best design projects happen through collaboration, I believe. And technology is good, but it's never the same as being in person with your team, with the stakeholders, with the users. So I would certainly say don't aspire to be a soloist. Aspire to be a collaborator and someone who is at the core of the organization and develop those relationships and develop those connections with people inside and outside your team, because that's how you're going to be effective. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, if we're not sort of giving you the right sort of feedback that you're wanting, feel free to chat in the comments and let us know if we need to cover a bit more stuff. We'll push on though. This question here, should I pursue a formal education in UX? It's also another one I think that pops up quite often. There hasn't been a lot of tertiary education courses offered so far in user experience specifically, but it does, I mean, the field of user experience is related to, you know, human-computer interaction, you know, cognitive psychology, and a whole bunch of sort of deeper foundations like that. And those courses have been around for a while. And the people that, you know, we know plenty of people that have studied those and moved into user experience design as well. So at the moment, I think it would be an advantage to get a tertiary qualification, but certainly not required. I think experience is still fairly, it's the sought after factor, being able to prove the work that you've done in the past, perhaps in, you know, 5 or 10 years, as the user experience design role changes, maybe there's more of us. I think the differentiator might be the formal education that you might have picked up from courses. There's a few places you can get this, you know, whether it be some of the larger universities have interaction courses, you know, here in Australia, Open Universities has some good courses too. So I wouldn't say it was required, but certainly might be something to consider if you've got the time and inclination.
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with Luke on this one. I'm having a hard time being convinced that a formal education in UX is going to be worthwhile. The value I see from getting some experience and like just taking a course like David's and then getting out there and doing it, using user testing as a starting point to then kind of build more experience in different areas, is such a powerful way to make progress and to progress your career. And I think that a formal education in UX, investing 3 years in learning about how to do this stuff or just getting 3 years experience in actually doing it, for me, I'll take the latter every time.
That is a good point. I'll stick to my original one, but yeah, I think that's a good point about, you know, it's an industry that's changing often, and being able to learn on the run is going to put you ahead of people that are learning. You know, if the course was designed a couple of years ago, you're still going to be behind a bit. So,
cool. All right, let's get on to the selling UX questions. What's the cheapest way you can make potential customers understand the need for UX testing? Logic doesn't work sometimes. Well, I did mention earlier the power of a good user testing video, and while I would never suggest presenting selective findings, it's important to be independent and tell the true story. Certainly, choosing snippets from your user testing videos to show people can be a very powerful way to get them on board with the idea. So if you've got someone who doesn't believe that, you know, the page that you're redesigning needs work, that they think it's fine, and you show them a video of someone struggling to work out where the button is because they just can't see it, then they're going to be pretty convinced by a real customer having a real problem. Another good thing that I like to do is actually involve stakeholders as user testing participants. So getting them to be the user tester, giving them some tasks, asking them to complete the tasks, and it forces them to take their owner hat off and be a user and realize the value of this process and realize that there are probably usability issues that need to be fixed. So there's two tips. Have you got any other tips to add?
Just looking at this sort of the selling UX section here, there's a few similarities in the questions. This idea of having to convince people about UX testing is certainly one that I've come up against myself time and time again. So I understand where the person asking the question is coming from, but probably what I would suggest is don't let it be an optional extra. Just don't necessarily even negotiate that. I think that user feedback sort of cycle that Matt was mentioning before is essential to the type of work we do. So don't let talking to the users be your first or second or even, you know, third thing that gets taken off the table when time and budget is tight. It's easier to say, harder to do, I know, but you know, similarly, I think if you did need to be able to sort of pitch it a bit more, I think you need to show some quick examples, as Matt said, about how previous projects have been improved by taking on board feedback from user testing, or, you know, borrowing from other people. So if there have been some other websites that you know of that have benefited from it, and you can show, you know, some before and after or a bit of process stuff, then I suppose that is still the logic that the person asking the question said didn't work. Ultimately, I would say just do it. Like, if you believe in it, you're probably going to already know that you can do a better job with it than without it. Testing, it doesn't have to be with 50 paid participants. It can be a bit on the run. Maybe you can include some customers of the client, pay them in kind with the client's products, or even use your own contacts or something like that. So there's a good article that we wrote on the website last year talking about sort of low budget UX, and that probably give you a few tips. I think you should just include it, and, you know, if you don't have the budget, then you just need to be able to squeeze it in there. But
I'm guessing, Luke, that you're referring to Cameron Rogers' article on no time, no excuses.
There's that one, no time, no excuses, and then there's also the one I wrote in August, the time poor small budget approach.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so Cameron's was a little bit controversial because he was basically advocating take a sickie and do it on your own, even though you've been told not to. Now, it depends on how much you value your job and what the organisational culture is, and whether you're in a position to take matters into your own hands or not, like that. But certainly, I agree with the sentiment that if your organisation needs to be enlightened, you might need to be a bit unconventional to enlighten them. So yes, if you've got an afternoon where you can squeeze in some user testing, even though you haven't told anyone about it, and then demonstrate the value of it, I think people are going to have a hard time telling you off for it.
Yeah, if you don't ask permission, they're not going to say no either, but yeah.
Yeah. and then there's another question in that group that I, if you can flick back, Luke. That's right. I was going to mention case studies. So there's a very famous case study that gets used, I'm sure, to make the case for user experience design, and that's Jared Spool's $300 million button. And we'll link to that case study in the webinar notes at the end of this. But basically, there's a case study for an organization where they changed the button on the page, and it resulted in increased conversions that meant an extra $300 million revenue for the organization for that year. And that's, if we could find more case studies like that, then we'd have an easier time championing user-centered design. So if anyone knows of any case studies where the design process made that big an impact, and we want to hear about it right now.
Definitely. And we'd love to hear that stuff.
Cool. All righty. Process and techniques. Do you practice Lean UX, and how do you apply it at work? Do you want to explain to the attendee list what Lean UX is, Luke?
Sure. So Lean UX is something that's come out of it's a reaction to a whole bunch of things that have been happening over the last couple of decades in development. We often go through these different phases where there's a bit of a take on things where this is a better way of doing something or whatever. And a little bit Lean UX has been the one doing the rounds lately, but the distinct advantages are, like we mentioned before, about that idea of, you know, not confusing user experience design with the deliverables or the actual artifacts. It's more about the process. I think Lean UX certainly sort of takes that and runs with it by saying, look, to be able to run a lean, you know, efficient project, you can cut back on the documentation and actually do the learning and the explaining with your team as you go along. Just focus on the core bits and pieces, and work quickly. And it's a bit of a design application of like the more development oriented sort of agile environment. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what it is. I've probably explained it really badly, but that's essentially what it is. So, yeah.
And I think
it's a good book.
Sorry, go.
So I was going to say, Matt did an interview with Jeff Gerthelf a couple of weeks ago, and Jeff's a leading voice on Lean UX and in that sort of industry. So definitely check out that article as well.
Yeah, and Jeff wrote an article for us recently too called Beyond the Basics, UX Skills for an Agile World, where he talks about some of the the premises of Lean UX and how that relates to working in an agile environment. So agile development processes traditionally aren't a good fit for user-centered design. And Jeff believes that if we become design facilitators and we apply a bunch of principles of transparency and letting go of owning the design and applying these kind of lean startup, validate your idea, validate your learnings process, then it is a good fit. And I'm in wholehearted agreement because, you know, the more transparent we are about what we do, it takes away the mystique of design being this black magic that we do behind closed walls and we present, voila, the masterpiece at the end of it. You know, it needs to be a team process, and in order to work with developers, we need to involve developers. And you'd be surprised at how many good ideas people have if you just ask them. And if they feel like they've been involved, then they'll become a champion for the design, and you have less of a hard time, you know, getting buy-in and getting take-up within the organization. If you go away and do something on your own and present it, then you're likely to hit a bunch of hurdles before everybody's on board with it, regardless of how good it is. Just because people don't like change and they don't like to, you know, everyone has an opinion about design, and so we need to involve them. How can UX principles be used to reduce cognitive complexity in educational products? That's a tricky question.
I'd love to learn more about that too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess simplicity is a good goal to aim for when you're designing something. So cognitive complexity is often the result of something being complex. So simplicity is hard, but really following a user-centered design process where you test stuff, where you have that user feedback loop, and you iterate and you prototype, and eventually you're going to get there, you know. But if you just think you can do it on your own, you're probably not. You need to involve others, stakeholders, team members, and users.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point about the cognitive load, like using psychological principles to improve an interface, especially in order to sort of clearly communicate and educate. Education in particular, I think, is really interesting for that because it's, you know, you can do a lot of stimulating by getting active involvement rather than sort of passive sort of consumption. But certainly UX should be able to help you identify where the unnecessary stuff is, to help simplify it, what the useful stuff is to keep. And, yeah, like Matt says, observing users using the system and testing proposed designs will both sort of help explicitly in terms of being able to find what that is, reduce that unnecessary cognitive complexity.
All right, the next question says, how do you balance SEO, CRO, and UX? So search engine optimization, conversion rate optimization, and user experience. And this is a great question because as UX designers, we're really focused on, is it usable? Is it useful? Is it the right product? And conversion rate optimization is really at the end of that pipeline. So we're all about making sure that things work well and do the right job for the right people. But then what color should the button be at the end of it? I think that you need to test that stuff at the end. So how do we balance it? Well, what we do is we get 90% of the way there using user-centered design techniques. And then if you're a large organization and like a 5% or a 6% conversion rate makes a big difference to your profit, then you test that stuff at the end to fine-tune it. SEO, it's funny. If you think about the user experience of someone finding information, really search engines are part of that touch point. So if someone types in a query in Google and then they end up on your website and then they find their answer, SEO is part of that experience. So I don't think they're at odds. I think that if you make sure that your website ranks well for the keywords that you want it to rank for, but you do it in a way that is going to help the customer answer their question, then you're ticking all the boxes. I don't think they necessarily need to be either or. We've only got a couple more minutes left.
I was going
to say,
go. Just quickly on that would be, I'm a little bit wary of the association with UX and sort of over-optimizing or that sort of really tight end. I mean, I know user experience design is certainly about optimizing and, you know, streamlining a process, particularly for the user. What I always come back to is the fact that I'm in within that business team, the business team obviously wanting to, you know, make money for the business. And, you know, that's part of that whole value equation of, you know, business exists to provide value to the customer. But I think my role as a user experience designer is very much to advocate for that user. So, you know, people ask me when I'm talking about user research, they often confuse that with market research. And I think they're very different things. Market research might be taken a bit more as a find some opportunities to exploit within the market or to understand the customer base, whereas I think user research is a lot more personal. It's also a lot more working with the user in order to help them achieve their goals and ultimately for that to be of value for the customer and the business.
Very good. We have time for a couple more questions, so I'm just going to jump down. There's a couple of questions at the end about can you share some of your challenges or frustrations? So the question says, what was your most frustrating project? We won't name any clients. And why was it frustrating and what was the outcome and how did I resolve the issue? So I do have a project that comes to mind that was frustrating, and that was many years ago before I was enlightened to the value of user-centered design, where I was working as a designer and I would go away and be creative and come up with a few different versions of the design and then come back and present it. And then we'd pick one and we'd launch it. And there were some real tensions, not really to do with me, but to do with other stakeholders, where the company owner and the CEO, it was a bit territorial because each of them thought that they had the best opinion on what the design should be. And I could just see that it was nothing to do with me, but the fact that this process wasn't speaking to everyone's need to be involved created some real tension and some really kind of nasty standoffs in the office. And in hindsight now, if I'd explained to everyone there that, hey, look, this is the process we're going to follow, if I'd done some collaborative sketching workshops where everybody got a chance to contribute, if I made it very clear and transparent what the process was that I was going to be following and how they'd be involved, everyone would be so much happier and there would be, you know, much less argy-bargy and arguing and passion about, but I haven't been involved in, but I know best. So the outcome was that we launched the front page and all of the users hated it because they weren't involved either. And I don't think the issue was resolved. I think that there's still some underlying tensions with that product where people resent having not been included and people don't like change, and whether that's stakeholders or users or anyone. So I learned from that. I didn't know at the time what the solution was, but it was my mentor that really enlightened me about user-centered design many years ago. And I haven't had that same problem since because I've deliberately followed a process that speaks to those challenges. Did you have a project you wanted to talk about, Luke?
Oh, just generally too. Like, I think that a lot of the frustrations come particularly out of the, you know, you need to define what UX is a little bit, and obviously people are still learning what that is a bit too. But, you know, it means that I had some similar experiences too. Like, one particular client had hired me, perhaps hearing that UX was a bit of a you know, it could help them solve some of their problems or something like that. But once I'd been working there for a little while, sort of turned out that their biggest problems were probably a bit more the workplace culture rather than the particular projects that we were working on. So it was always a bit of an uphill battle to advocate for the user above all the rest of that noise of the business that was intent on doing its sort of own thing. So I had to get a lot better at convincing, you know, people about importance of things or having a bit of a stronger voice there, but I still felt that the role was a bit token. So that was probably the most frustrating thing for me. Stepping back from that a little bit, I think looking at my early forays into user-centered design, the two things that internally I felt frustrated were about, like I mentioned, about the documents, and probably spending a little bit too much energy on making the documents look good. As a sort of a details person with a design background, I fell really easily into spending a lot of time on the documents, making them communicate well rather than involving people in my activities, and flying more by the seat of my pants. And the other thing was probably trying to understand when to test and when not to. So initially I used to test all my early design concepts as well, but I didn't realize that I was focusing on interactions that didn't really even exist yet. So I was just kind of going through the motions, doing testing because everyone was telling me to do it, but I didn't actually make the connection that it wasn't the best use of my time, and that a lot of that extra data to process didn't necessarily have much benefit, and I needed to focus on only testing because it's we've got a particular question that we need an answer to. So I think that applies to user research as well, but they were probably the two biggest things that once I had a bit more of an understanding of them, a lot of things got a bit easier.
All right, very good. Well, we've come to the end of the webinar. Unfortunately, we don't have time to answer any more questions, but we're really appreciative of everyone who's dialed in, and we apologise to those of you whose questions we didn't get to. We would like to do this again. This is actually really valuable for us.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's valuable.
Great being able to talk to you guys as well and hear you like asking questions back in the chat. I really appreciate that.
Totally, yeah. Sometimes the newsletter and the website can feel very one way, and we much prefer it to be a conversation. So keep emailing your questions, keep the conversation going. If you've got any specific feedback on this webinar, we'd love to hear from you.
We'd certainly love to hear you, yeah.
Yeah, so just email feedback@uxmastery.com and let us know if you loved it, if you hated it, if you're indifferent, if you wish that we'd answered your question and we didn't. We can do our best to try and do that offline or perhaps in a future webinar. I did mention that we've got an ebook in the works, and we're going to be working very hard to get that out the door soon, so you'll certainly be hearing from us about that hopefully pretty soon. I won't say a time frame because, you know, clients get in the way, and this stuff's hard to do in our spare time, but we do our best. So thank you everyone for attending, especially those of you in time zones where it wasn't easy. We do appreciate your time and for listening to us, and hopefully we'll see you on a future UX Mastery webinar.
Thank you everyone. Bye bye.
See you guys.